board to order. You should have in front of you the agenda, the consent agenda, and the minutes of the January meeting, which was held at Borlaug Hall. It was a case of musical chairs where we went back and forth, but I thought a great meeting and a good opportunity to learn, certainly from our partners at the U. So if you find it in your heart to move the consent agenda, including the minutes of the January 25th meeting, that would be a good thing.
I so move.
There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Is there discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Thank you. Let's, first of all, maybe start with Brian and go around. We have a new member at the table today, and I think we'll start with introductions for the benefit of Kristen and those that are in the room, particularly some of the new staff members. So, Brian?
My name is Brian Napstead, Chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
And where did you go to high school?
In Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh. Madison East, Madison West, Madison Central.
And if you're going to ask me if I'm a Packer fan, you do not grow up around Vince Lombardi and Bart Starr without becoming
one. Well, there's a few things we need to know about members around, so let's just kind of follow along here.
I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner, Department of Transportation, and I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota.
All right. Omi.
Yeah. Kind of.
Where'd you go to high school?
Oh, you still waiting for that?
Yes. Yeah.
St. Paul.
Charlie flunked out.
St. Paul Academy.
St. Paul Academy.
Oh,
all right. Tells a lot.
Our tribal to another commissioner.
Don't worry about that.
Is there a spoon by your phone? Anyway.
Yeah, it's silver. Let him eat cake.
Is this on the record, by any way?
You started this, Commissioner.
Yeah, I know.
I'm Kate Knuth, a citizen member from the Twin Cities. And I went to Irondale High School with one of the best marching bands in the state.
And you were in it, obviously.
Yeah.
Of course.
I'm Spencer Kronk, the Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and I went to Hopkins High School.
Oh, cool.
Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and Old Deer Cretan High.
You look like a Cretan.
I've always been tough on their haircuts.
High and tight.
John Saxhoe, citizen member from the Twin Cities, and I went to Grand Rapids High School. Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
There we go. Yeah, another one back there.
Hey, there he is.
Aaron.
Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health, and I went to Premontre High School, which is a high school in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where the football coach was a Packer Hall of Famer, and we got to use all the Packer used equipment. So I wore Bart Starr's helmet, Ray Nischke's shoes, Max McGee's shoulder pads. So I have to be a Packer fan.
Talk about cred.
Had eBay been around, you wouldn't have to be.
And I sold beer at the Packer games.
Talk about cred. There you go.
I've you know, officed across the hall from
you
for
know
3 years,
it.
And I did not know that. And our newest member.
Yes. It's delightful to be on this side of the table. I'm thrilled, Kristen Idy Tollison. I'm from Florence Township, Goodhue County, and I'm a third, fourth generation Minnesotan. I've never lived anywhere else.
And your high school was?
My high school was Wayzata. The Trojans, Wayzata High School.
Can you sing the song?
Not right now.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as the Commissioner of Agriculture and also the Chair of the Environmental Quality Board. And my high school is a little town in western Minnesota called Murdoch. Yes, they did have a high school there, but no longer.
Will Seufert, and my high school was is in Wakefield, Rhode Island. And so, yes, there are a few of us. And my new staff is from Rhode Island, too, so I'm pretty excited about that. We don't have a football team, though, so sorry. Yeah.
Because if you had one, then we'd want one.
Yeah. Okay, I get it.
Thanks, Steve. John Linkstein, I'm a commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. I went to Alexander Ramsey High School in Roseville, Minnesota, which was unfortunately merged with a rival school, Frank B. Kellogg, and is now Roseville Area High School.
Tough.
Kate
Katie Clark Sieben with Deed, and I went to Janesville Craig High School in Janesville, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I don't really follow the Packers. But yeah.
But you do follow presidential candidates.
Yes. Paul Ryan was a high school, not a classmate of mine. I'm a little younger than he is.
Good.
Yeah.
Cool.
My name's Eric Tomlinson. I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities. And I went to high school at Eau Claire Memorial, also in Wisconsin. Mm. And I am also a Packer.
Got a score going now.
I'm Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead, and I went to Jefferson High School in Alexandria, and I am not a Packer fan.
I'm Sandy Rummel, representing the Met Council, and I went to high school in Fairfield, Connecticut. So I'm a foreigner, and I had no idea there were a team called the Packers.
Well, thank you. That's been highly educational, and I hope you thought so also. I just wanted to take the opportunity to, again, thank Kristen for agreeing to serve on this board, and be happy to give you a little time to have your moment here to talk about some of your background work. And
okay, well, that's very kind.
You
I think
bet.
I'll take you up on that. First of all, I want to say that I'm a long-time constituent of EQB, and probably we would not be here had I not been on a Citizens Advisory Committee on Nuclear Waste more than 10 years ago. And I have really grown up and learned what it is to be in the public realm, really through the agency, through agency staff, have been major mentors to me. And one of the perspectives that I hope to bring here is small local government. I'm in a small township which is sort of a poster child for getting support and technical help from the state. When we did our comprehensive plan, we used your under construction, the community-based local planning book, and when we went to do our implementation, we used the Department of Natural Resources, natural resource-based planning model, and one of our own DNR local people, Beth Knutson, who's just a wonderful resource, was did her, I think it was her graduate work in St. Mary's on Florence Township and created a whole set of maps for us that became the foundation of our sensitive features resource ordinance. And, you know, that really is how we have worked with the state and with state resources, and are very grateful for those connections. So, and Florence Township is actually one of the townships that does not have frac sand mining because of our sensitive resource base. And I look especially forward to working with the other citizen members and to helping to make connections with the grassroots, with citizens, with local government. And my training is, I went to the Humphrey Institute in a mid-career program back and graduated in 2006 on public engagement and energy policy planning, infrastructure development, with a sidetrack in environmental planning. So I really am very honored to be on this side of the table, and look forward to my time.
We're certainly pleased to have you.
Give me a moment.
Involvement with Kristen was at the Dinkytown Bookstore, which she is a proud owner, and I have a problem in that I am a bibliophile, and the only book I ever missed was the one I didn't buy. And unfortunately, when you walk into Kristen's store, there's lots of opportunity to buy. And so on my tombstone, I would like it to say, he just ran out of shelf space.
say it again.
He just ran out of shelf space. And many of them have come from your bookstore, by the way. So. Oh. All right. Well, thank you. I'll go then to Executive Director Will's report.
I
Just wanted to real quickly thank everybody, commissioners and staff, who attended our meeting at the University of Minnesota St. Paul last month. We thought it was really informative, and we hope to make this a trend of doing meetings outside of St. Paul. And I know some of you have agencies to run, and so we will do our best to balance your logistical demands and staff resources. But we do think it's important that we do is take advantage of opportunities to go outside of St. Paul and conduct our business away from here. So we will continue on that trend. One bit of follow-up from that meeting, we have been in touch with some youth leaders about their proposal at the last meeting, and we're working to refine that internship opportunity as well as creating another one that we could maybe house in our environmental review program. And so this is ongoing, and we will keep you updated, but we're very excited to work with some of these student leaders. Just want to take a couple minutes to provide some meeting context for what we're doing here today. We have a couple real brief updates related to environmental review and silica sand projects, and then we're going to adjourn the full board and reconvene as a climate change subcommittee. That was intentional so we could keep as many of you here for that, since this is our first subcommittee meeting, if possible. But just to kind of orient everyone to what we're doing with respect to climate change, you know, why? I mean, the first question, but why is the EQB doing this work? Why are we being involved? Statute 116C directs the board to investigate matters of interdepartmental concern, and it would be really hard to find any other environmental issue that cuts across as many jurisdictions as climate change does. So it's a really appropriate issue for us to be considering. And, you know, in the listening sessions in 2012, the Environmental Congress and then the GICD planning process really identified this as a, if not the primary issue for the board to delve into in 2014. And so that's the background for why we're approaching this issue altogether. But with respect to the subcommittee, if you recall, in November we heard an interagency presentation on adaptation, and we formalized this subcommittee at that point. As I mentioned, this is the first meeting. I just want to remind everyone the purpose and the charge of the subcommittee. It is to oversee staff work and the projects that we're working on, and also public engagement. And so we're going to be periodically scheduling subcommittee meetings throughout the calendar year to create opportunities for public input and for your own, for board input as well. And so, you know, with respect to the goal of this meeting itself, is we want to provide some definition and clarity of what climate change projects are already underway at the board. A lot of staff work has been going on behind the scenes for months now, and a lot is being planned for the future. And so, given all these moving parts, we want to provide a sense of kind of how these are all integrated and give you an opportunity to shape them as you see fit, and also explore a little bit how these fit into other efforts going on at the state and federal level that don't directly involve EQB. We also want to explore some opportunities for public and stakeholder engagement. So whether or not you're on the subcommittee, please do provide input as you see fit. Real briefly, I want to just introduce, since we've gone through some hiring at the board and our staff is complete now, we've got some new faces here, and I want to take a minute to introduce them. So I'm going to real quickly read just a couple bios, and then staff can identify themselves. I hired Anna Henderson as our climate and energy specialist. And Anna, you can wave. And as I mentioned, Anna is a former Rhode Islander. I did not know that until recently, so I'm really excited about that. Anna brings over 8 years of experience as a PhD geologist and public policy advisor. 2013, Anna was selected as an American Association for the Advancement of Science Congressional Science Policy Fellow. In this capacity, Anna served as an advisor to U.S. Senator Al Franken, member of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee working on energy efficiency and renewable energy, including programs related to biofuels, combined heat and power, and loan guarantees, as well as agriculture programs promoting rural energy development, land conservation, training young new farmers. Prior to her work in the Senate, Anna was a geoscience researcher at Penn State University, investigating ancient climate changes and their impacts on water and ecosystem. She also collaborated with fossil fuel and biofuel industries on research related to hydrocarbon exploration and engineering. She holds a PhD from the University of Minnesota and a BA from Brown University in geology. She's done field work in field work in the Great Plains, the Rocky Mountains, the Eastern Seaboard, Alaska, and Ghana. She enjoys spending time outdoors camping, biking, and canoeing with her husband and two sons. So welcome to the team, Anna. Yeah. And then finally, we also...
High school, Will.
What, yeah, Anna, what high school?
Classical High School. Our mascot was the color purple.
Ah,
The actual crayon?
That's a local tire. Yeah.
We also hired a rulemaking specialist to lead our Silica Sand rulemaking effort and to work on initiating a rulemaking to update our mandatory categories later this year, and that's Eric Dahl. So, Eric, if you want to wave to everybody. Eric Dahl is a planner and GIS specialist. He graduated from the University of St. Thomas with a major in English and writing, and then spent several years writing technical copy for Cycle Sport magazine before returning to school to pursue his passion for urban and regional planning and policy. He graduated from the Humphrey Institute with a master's in urban and regional planning with an emphasis on water policy and environmental planning. After graduating, Eric and his wife Alyssa headed to Uganda with Engineers Without Borders to work on irrigation and high-efficiency stove solutions for a rural community. After completing studies with the Humphrey and returning from Africa, Eric began working at the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District as a planner and GIS specialist. There he led several major studies for MCWD. He has also developed interactive online GIS mapping solutions and managed GIS data to provide analytical support to all departments within MCWD. Eric grew up in Wisconsin along the banks of the St. Croix River and enjoys canoeing, cross-country, and camping throughout Minnesota. Maybe you can tell us where your high school is.
Hudson, Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, thanks again for everyone's time. Real quickly, our next meeting, as you all know, is in Rochester, where we're going to be considering the model standards, also known as the tools. Sure, yeah. Why? How about if you work for the EQB, you stand up right now, just because Dave reminded me that not everybody probably knows your faces. So slowly we are taking over this room. Yes. And Caroline, you can wave. Caroline, she started, everyone started within the last couple of months. And Megan as well. And then you all know Kate and Jeff. So Great. Thank you guys. And then real quickly, in closing, we're going to Rochester for our March meeting. And so please stay in touch with me if there are any scheduling issues that arise, just because I know mid-March travel during the middle of session can be a little challenging, and we just want to make sure we're communicating on schedules if any issues come up. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Any questions for Will? All right. Let's move then to the environmental review progress update and ask Kate France to come, and Megan.
Is that better?
Yep.
There we go. Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Kate France. I am the environmental review lead for EQB. And incidentally, I went to St. Anthony Village High School, right in the Twin Cities. So, and with me today is Megan Eichen, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Megan Eichen. Nice to see you, Chair and members of the board. I grew up on a cattle farm in Iowa where we grow the Packers, actually. My cousin plays and has a Super Bowl ring from the Packers. So.
Oh, man. Go ahead and top that.
So what we'd like to talk to you about today is a little bit of a reprise. We talked a little bit about this last September, and so this is another update regarding the Environmental Review Improvement Report that was part of the Executive Order 1132 and the outcomes that we're achieving based off of that. So just to remind you and to give some context to our newer board members, the Executive Order 1132 signed by the governor guided us to composing this report, the Environmental Review Improvement Report, and it included those little bullets in blue there, and the report was approved by the EQB in November of 2012 with six prioritized recommendations. Those six are, just to again show that, the first two are really where we've been focusing, again, with our skeleton staff, we've got to prioritize, so that's where we've really been focusing so far. So up until now, the last time we talked to you in September, we had talked about the updated EAW form that's now been published. In addition, the guidance for that form has been published as well, the EAW guidelines. So that's available to any users of the EAW. That's been completed, and for our next steps, now that that guidance is done, we've connected with the University of Minnesota with their environmental review course. It's an undergraduate course, and we'll be working with them to revise our Citizen's Guide to the Environmental Review series. That's a set of four guidance documents that are directed at citizens, members of the public, people that are uninitiated to the environmental review program. So we thought that undergraduates, who will be our colleagues in a few short years, were a perfect audience to work with on that. Secondly, is the developing a better system of making information available. This was something that was regularly focused on within our report, as well as within the focus groups that were involved with this effort. So what we've been doing is converting all of our records. Remember, we receive the environmental review documents that RGUs all over the state conduct. And we keep those records in perpetuity. So we have some 40 years of records that are in boxes within the PCA and within our archives. So we are working on bringing those to an electronic face, which then can be accessed by staff internally and hopefully eventually by the public as well. So up till this point, we've been working very closely with our PCA colleagues on incorporating an EQB-specific framework into the existing on-base database system that the PCA uses for records management. And those records, thus far, we have one full year of records that can be accessible. Those are findings of facts, EAWs, EISs, those types of things. So that's been a real accomplishment, and we have to thank Caroline primarily for that. She's been doing a lot of work on that. And so our next steps are not only to be moving forward, but also to be moving backward on those historical records to make them available not only to staff internally and for data practices, but also to make them externally available as well. So this is just sort of what it would look like if you're an internal staff. As you can see, we have document types that are specifically set up for EQB that make sure that our records are transportable, our records are unique and separate from PCA. That makes sure that we don't have any confusion about where that should be defined. And as you can see, we have, if you were to do a quick search on just a date category, you would have a lot of records that would come back. And this is just what a record looks like. This is an example of an email record that would be coming back. This is a request for a publication. It's just an example. So in relation to this and making our data more available to the public as well as environmental review users, what we are looking to do is developing an environmental review mapping tool. So what our proposal that we're putting together is that we want to connect these records that we're building at right now in the database to a GIS scale mapping tool. It would be based on existing agency mapping applications. Many of the agencies already have these types of applications in place, so we wouldn't be restarting, but it would be making our information as well. And we really envisioned this in terms of three tiers of functionality, just so that we have a scaled approach to this project. Tier one involves the basic mapping functionality, basically getting that information out there, available, searchable. Tier 2 brings that mapping functionality, but with the effort to integrate some of the other data sources from other agencies to sort of lay those over each other so you can see not only where environmental review locations are, but potentially permitted locations or special resources as well. And then Tier 3 really brings the mapping functionality and the integration of other data, and then the development of supporting tools, whether those are project trackers or other applications, a mobile app. And with that, I'm going to let Megan sort of explain the technological piece of that.
This is a graphic representation of kind of what we're thinking about. The functionality isn't built or anything, but using existing platforms like GeoRilla, like DOT uses, or the Data Deli, as the DNR has, we're not reinventing the wheel here. We want to use information and things that have already been put into play so that we can use those platforms and take our information to make it integrate with them. The categories that we have defined into the database We'll be using the, if you look at the kind of rainbow representation on the side, the categories have been defined by Kate and Caroline. They're working on making sure that those are joined in with the things that make sense, like feedlots, public utilities commission, transmission lines, genetically engineered organisms, bridge construction. Those are some of the programs and projects that come in to the EQB for environmental review. So, for example, if you're moving into a new house and you'd like to be able to search by attribute or location, you can look things up in your area and engage in the process. So if you have questions about documents that might be going through, we can show you those locationally and geographically in the GIS application here. We'd also like to be able to have people search by RGU, so Regulating Governing Unit, the type of project, the project title, to see examples of documents that you can use. So Kate explained that we have kind of a three-tier system. Tier one is the basic mapping functionality, which is the foundation that the other two tiers are built on. Tier one has essentially the environmental review mapping web application. We're limited to the amount of, go ahead. We have conversion of the documents, as Kate mentioned. Carolyn has been working very seriously on the last couple of months since she's been there, and the conversion of these documents is kind of time-consuming. As you've heard Kate say, 40 years of documents in a box somewhere has been quite daunting. So we're starting to convert those documents. So we'd like to look at maybe getting 10 years up on the web to be in this tool to start with, so something that we can kind of take a bite off of and make something realistic happen. And then we'd like all of our documents that go up into this application to be ADA compliant. It's been kind of a challenge for the state of Minnesota as they're looking at converting a lot of the old physical documents into documents that someone with a screen reader can be able to read. So we'd like to start that off as we convert these documents. We'd like to start right and do this so that people are able to access them. Tier number two is, building on top of the tier one components. The ongoing conversion of the historical projects that I just mentioned. So taking that 10 years and building on to 20 years, 30 years, whatever we can get to. Again, 40 years is a lot of records to look at as a state agency. We'd also like to integrate with other agencies to their data, like GeoRilla, like the Data Deli, like the What's in My Neighborhood that PCA has. There's a lot of very, very good information out there, and MnGeo is trying to work on getting all of the agency systems to be able to talk to one another, and we'd like to be working with that and making sure that that's happening with environmental review. So on top of the tier one and tier two, tier three is kind of our exciting wish list of things that we'd like to put into this application, which involves a mobile version. So something that someone could hold on a mobile phone and take the location and say, I am located in St. Paul, Minnesota. What kind of environmental review projects are going on here in my area? And again, if you're going to buy a house somewhere, you might locationally be able to find out what's happening in your community. We'd also like to put together some tutorial information to let people know how they can use this information, how it's useful to them, and help RGUs be able to navigate some of the environmental review pieces if they have questions and things like that. Could be a YouTube video, could be something printed out, could be, you know, we're kind of still working on that. And we'd also like to be able to do something sort of like a timeline project management thing to be able to show people where their project is currently. So if they're looking at something like a feedlot, where is that project now and where is it headed? What is the direction that it's going in?
So with that, that's our project. If you have any questions on the project or things that you'd like to, things that you'd like us to consider as we move forward with this proposal, we're open for questions.
And also, if you notice the logo up there, it's a new logo. We'd like to run that past you and see what you think about that. We've kind of adjusted the look of the logo.
It's cleaner.
I can't determine what the old one looked like.
So that's a good thing?
I don't know.
The old one was a circle. This one is more of an oval.
Oh, okay.
Not that different.
Right.
So if you look there in the corner.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that
so that's
the
our
one
current
I picked,
one,
right? Yeah. Okay. Sure.
The advantage of a new logo is that our previous logo, it's not as high of a quality image, and so in terms of printing and those things, there have been some limitations. So we're trying to work through those, and one of those is to create a higher quality digital logo. So we're not looking
forward to the new one.
Yep. Yep, I certainly will.
We'd like to have a banner printed for you for the backdrop here, and so we needed to have a better logo.
Yeah. Flashback. There you go. Okay, I see.
So it opens it up more.
Yeah. More high quality, yeah.
It's cleaner.
It's much cleaner.
That's right.
Legible, even.
Open. Legible. Fresh.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple things. First off, on the logo, it surely occurs to me that that's a seagull flying in the top right corner, and I would strongly encourage we could get some bird other than a seagull. You know, maybe not a crow, but something. Or a duck. Or
noted.
Secondly, I'm a big fan of mobile apps, but I have serious questions as to whether or not anybody would use a mobile app for environmental review projects. So I'd want us to think about that a little bit more in terms of what an application might look like and if it would be used. We could put a lot of money into that and have two people use it, and I don't think that would necessarily be a good outcome. I would think if I'm going to buy a house, I'd do my homework at home on a desktop or laptop before I'd go out on the road. But
dinosaur town.
Worth pondering a little bit more. What are you laughing at? No such thing as a desktop anymore?
I was just saying there are people of a different generation that don't require such devices anymore.
Whole applications, I'll tell you. Because I implore it. So.
Excellent.
Obviously, you can't tell the difference between a seagull and a walleye, though. It's a flying walleye.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Landry, that's thank you for that feedback. That's why we've included that as our Tier 3. We really envision that as something that would be pursued following usability testing, getting bugs out at the desktop phase, and really moving toward that after we've sort of got our feet under us with the data being more available on a web application first.
I guess I might make one suggestion on Tier 3.
Why don't you punch your speaker up also? Or have you got it?
I believe it's on.
It's on.
Can you hear me? Okay. Under Tier 3, I saw tutorial and documentation, and I guess I might suggest that be phased as appropriate in the first two tiers. So as users are starting to use it, they have some sort of tutorial on how to use the phased, or each phase.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just, first of all, this GIS mapping looks like it's going to be a great way to collate data and get to it quickly and easily. You mentioned a couple times the boxes of data that need to be put on there, and I took that literally, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking of instances where you also use the example of somebody's buying a house. I'm thinking of a closed landfill. Maybe it's been closed for 20 years. My question is that information that would ordinarily be available on the internet today just harder to get to, or are you actually going back to information that's not even available electronically today and getting it into an electronic format so that it can be accessed.
Oh, I can answer the closed landfill program. I mean, what's in your neighborhood on the PCA's website is contains data about all kinds of facilities or places like that where there was Superfund projects, where there were documentation of hazardous substance releases and cleanup conducted. Closed landfills are one of those. So there, it's on our website. And I would just echo what I heard Kate say, which is they're building on sort of the backdrop of existing agency data sets. So this isn't like adding new, it is adding new information to that backdrop. So that if you think about all of the effort that goes into an EAW, I would assume, or an EIS, all of that documentation is now going to be attached to a location. And so you're going to be able to pull up that complete record of an EIS or an EAW and review the complete record of what data they considered, what local information they included in their EAW. So I think what this will do is just augment what's on current web-based material that state agencies and others have contributed. Spencer stepped out, but I was going to mention the state is working on governance of its data systems right now across the administration, and this is an important, this ownership of data and the value of the data and how it is used across an enterprise is one of the important things that Spencer has got an initiative to address right now. So this sounds very compatible and consistent, and I like the logo. Other than I agree with Commissioner Landwehr about the seagull.
Other comments, Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's great to make data more accessible and useful. And as someone who doesn't always feel comfortable doing that or figuring out how to use it, I'm curious how you've solicited input from your data users to reflect their needs in this design. I'm assuming you've done that somehow. If not, how do you include that in the process?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, and Member Knuth, thus far, the basis for our data collection has been based on our responsibility in keeping our data mm-hmm. and in keeping it in a form that's most accessible. So those are just our responsibilities as a state agency. And we haven't done focus groups at this time because those are our responsibilities as a state agency to keep that data. And the other form that I've been responsive to is, since I am the primary respondent to the Environmental Review Hotline, I can tell you personally that our most common request is either example of petitions, example of EAWs, or example of AUARs. And this is exactly what we will be doing, is providing that information directly to those folks. So in a passive way, that's what we're dealing with. In a more active way, that's part of the project to move forward with usability testing, those types of things.
Other questions? Follow-up, Kate?
I think probably in terms of someone who's working on it as the person who's I appreciate the, we keep this data, that's part of our responsibility, and have it communicated. And I think that any more formalized or invitation into helping design this so it meets people's needs. And I think by the person that answers the hotline, I think that's, you should be the person working on this. You probably have a better sense than any of us, certainly than I do. But I would just encourage you to kind of explicitly think about how to solicit that input in maybe a more active way as you're continuing to work on it.
Thank you. We will.
Mr. Chair, Kate and Megan, I might have missed this, but for planning purposes, do you have a timeline for implementation of the tiers?
We're still coordinating with the Minute PCA and MnGeo, as well as other staff that are involved with environmental review process, like Kate, trying to figure out what's a realistic timeline for getting all of these documents together. We have a year's worth up now. As they go backwards, they get more difficult to turn into an electronic document. So we're still working on that.
I just want to clarify a couple things, too. What we're doing, you know, there's ongoing staff work to build this database. That's going to happen regardless of whether this website application can be developed. But we are looking for opportunities to seek funds, quite frankly, and we're working with IT staff here at MPCA and at MnGeo to define what that one-time request would need to be to actually move this forward on a reasonable timeline. Because we see a lot of, I mean, we see a lot of value to, you know, to local units of government who, you know, who have to do the reviews, wanting to see what other comparable projects, what they look like, and the ability to easily access that information. We see value to project proposers who are thinking about a project and want to see what environmental review entails for something like that. And we also see a lot of value for citizens who want to be engaged in these projects in their communities. And so we're trying to find a way to bring our technology in the 21st century. And this is, and part of the timing is not only budget cycle, but also is driven by this unsession theme. And as we reflect on what that means to us at the EQB, we think with respect to environmental review program, our ability to really offer the kind of improvement in value is in making this information accessible quickly. So that's where we're working for.
I think you've identified a need, and obviously we're a long way from implementing tier 1, 2, and 3. And that's going to require some resources. So that will be an ongoing discussion and probably even a debate here among the members of the board. At least I hope so. So. Other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Let's go then to our silica sand project update. And Mr. Jeff Schmeiser will present. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Make this quick, unless you have more questions. Three things I'll give you the update on. The tools to assist local governments document put together to fulfill the statutory requirement for model standards and criteria. I recall that the board extended the comment period to January 27th. Even after that, we've still had some comments trickling in. We're taking a look at them all. We had 68 comment messages, I'll call them, in one form or another, whether they were emails or letters. 26 of the emails had attachments that were letters ranging from one page to 40 pages. In each one of these comment messages, we've been reviewing the comments, we're revising the document, and we still plan to bring the final document to the March 19th board meeting. We are on schedule for that. For the library, the Silica Sand Library, we now have 18 local government unit ordinance documents in that library. There are two permits. One's a conditional use permit, one's an interim use permit. We have one moratorium, which is an interim ordinance, another form of ordinance. We have one road agreement for reference for people. This will be growing. It's work in progress, like any library. Its collection will grow over time. Future possibilities that I was thinking when we first put this plan together that might be useful. Land use mapping for the different jurisdictions, land use categories on the maps, industrial land use chapters from comprehensive plans, perhaps. Maybe mining information from comprehensive plans, maybe transportation section info, if there's anything about planning for transloading facilities, things like that. Those are certainly possibilities. Another possibility would be actually including the state enabling statutes for planning and zoning for counties, municipalities, and townships into the future. That was part of the original plan when I was putting this together, so we'll see what happens. the silica sand rulemaking advisory panel. First meeting was on January 29th. At that meeting, they were the discussion include what's the panel's role, how does rulemaking operate under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 14, of course, introducing all the panel people to each other, why they were interested in it, what they were charged with doing, things like that, established ground rules for the panel meetings, and the future meetings will be focusing on more specific elements. Now, the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources are really the lead two agencies on running this advisory panel. The EQB, we're sort of tagging along, you might say, but that doesn't mean our role is any less important from the perspective of the statutory requirement. We still have to look at revising our statutes. So that's what we will be doing. Those are the updates.
Those are the three areas, rulemaking, standards, and library. Are there any questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I forgot something. The technical advisory team is established. It's available for information. I mean, it's available to assist local governments if they want to request thing. We have not received any formal requests for assistance yet. We'll see what happens in the future. But they are available. Recall that we did discuss how that team will operate when we adopted the resolution establishing that team. So I guess we're waiting for assistance. I think a lot of people out there are waiting for the tools document to be completed and then see where they go from there. That's our guess. See what happens.
Yes.
Jeff, what's your plans for getting a draft to the EQB board members prior to the March 19th meeting?
It will go out. The plan is that the final document will go out with the board packet, which goes out at least 10 days before the board meeting, which will be March 7th.
Thank you.
Other questions, Tom?
Jeff, the fact that we haven't gotten any requests makes me wonder, how are we letting people know that we've got this available? And do we have a sort of public outreach plan for letting local units of government, counties, and townships know that this resource is available and or these other things that are coming down?
At this time, our concentration has been on getting the tools document finished. I think the people who have been following are quite aware that that technical assistance team was completed. The revised document will have further explanation of the technical assistance team. To remind people that it's there. I guess we'll sort of have to think about how to do what you're saying in the near future. Right now, we are concentrating on getting the tools document out there.
I'm sure the counties know, but I wouldn't be so sure about the townships. And we did, part of our trips down in the southeast last fall was to get the word out and solicit local comment. It might be useful to think about how we bring that information back out and let people know it's available. Encourage their participation.
Mr. Chair.
John?
I talked to Will about this too. I think part of the I agree with what Jeff said, that I think people are waiting to see what the tools document will say, but also I think it would be useful to have some kind of a procedural guide for a unit of government who wants to request assistance. What does that look like? Do I have to have a resolution from my governing body? Does the county zoning administrator call? Just some guidance on how to access the group and what that should look like, so that there's not a misunderstanding about how they're going to engage. And I think having something documented would be very helpful to the staff, so that they don't over or under aim when it comes to meeting the local unit of government's requests. So from just a sort of a practitioner standpoint, maybe something in the guidebook in the local tools could just lay out a quick, here's how you get help. And then that would be a more understandable, and would give you something to promote to local units of government.
I see Megan is taking copious notes, so I suspect you're on it, right?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Let's see. Am I on? Okay. I want to say how gratifying it was to be able to look at all the comments online. I really commend staff for having that all up. And I read through all of them, everyone's comments. And there are two things I wanted to check in on. One of Uniman's comments and was about the importance of clarifying the roles of state and local governments within the document so that local governments come out of using that document less confused, not more confused, and understanding what they do and don't have a primary responsibility for. And the second thing was Houston County and a number of other people did continue to request that there be some guidance about showing a small local government what the process that they might go through or what the opportunities were to not choose to have silica sand mining. I don't know how that's coming, but there's a lot of still interest in that from the grassroots. So I wondered about those two things.
Other questions or comments? Seeing none, we are at the end of our EQB agenda, and I would like to mention that at the end of our committee hearing, there will be an opportunity for comments from any and all that are here participating in the meeting today. So if you don't mind hanging around until that, we will at this time adjourn. If there is a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Same sign, the motion carries. And then I will pass the gavel to John.
All right.
Who will chair the committee meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and board members. If you want to stay at the table, stay at the table.
Stay as guests.
You're allowed to sit at this table. Thank you, Commissioner Zelli. Yes, absolutely.
Like permission to leave, though, as well, John.
Since Tom did not have permission to speak, let me just call the meeting to order.
Finally going to get some decorum around this place, right?
Well, I'm not leaving, Dave.
So this is the climate change subcommittee, and members, you should have agendas. Those of you on the board have an agenda, and we've got four items today. We're going to have a briefing on the Federal Clean Air Act climate change framework from David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner here at the Pollution Control Agency. After which, Ellen Anderson will give us a progress report on the EQB climate change framework document. And Ellen will be presenting that. Then we're going to have an update from energy on energy planning from Bill Grant from the Department of Commerce. And lastly, we'll talk about the project that is updating existing climate data in Minnesota. And I just wanted to echo what Will described earlier, which is the climate change emphasis for the board, you might recall, grew out of a lot of conversation at the Environmental Congress, followed by the workshops that we had with the Governor's Institute on community design. And so we've been focusing on this issue, and today we're going to get our first look at sort of some of the products and future materials that will be coming. But Ellen's done a great job at sort of briefing us on this in the past, so let's just dive in. And feel free to ask questions, David, while you're going. Is that your preference, that we interrupt with questions along the way if you have any? Thanks. David?
That would be excellent. Thank you. Again, David Thornton, Pollution Control Agency, Texas Senior High School, Texarkana, Texas. I'm going to talk about the Clean Air Act and how it's being used to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And I only have about 13 slides. I might get a little bit deeper than you're comfortable with in how the Clean Air Act works, but there are only three things I want you to remember when I'm done. And this is the first one. The Clean Air Act was not written with climate change or greenhouse gas emissions in mind. It was drafted in the 70s, 60s, enacted in the 70s, amended in 1990. By the time it was amended, people were starting to talk about climate change, but nobody had any idea what might need to be done about it. So it's not, the framework of the Clean Air Act is not elegantly conducive to regulating greenhouse gas emissions. But there is a section in the Clean Air Act that leads us to a path for regulating greenhouse gases that the administrator of the EPA has taken. And that starts with Section 202, which requires the administrator of EPA to establish standards applicable to the emissions of any air pollutant from new motor vehicles which cause or contribute to air pollution which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. In 1999, during the previous administration, the International Center for Technology Assessment and others, it was a number of states and cities, petitioned EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles under this section. In 2003, again during the previous administration, the EPA administrator determined that it lacked authority to regulate greenhouse gases and declined to set emission standards for motor vehicles. However, a number of states sued EPA right away, led by Massachusetts and joined by a number of cities, and that led to a 2007 Supreme Court decision in the case that's been referred to as Massachusetts et al. Versus EPA, that EPA indeed had the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, and they remanded the case to EPA for further consideration of the petition to develop motor vehicle regulations. In response to the Supreme Court remand, EPA found that current and projected levels of six greenhouse gases threaten health and human welfare of current and future generations, and that greenhouse gases from motor vehicles contribute to the problem of climate change. This is a finding that EPA made again in 2009 that everybody refers to as the endangerment finding. This is being litigated, but we'll assume that EPA will prevail on this.
And David, who brought the litigation against EPA, do you know?
You know, offhand, I don't. I didn't look that up.
All right.
I could speculate, but I don't want to do that. And that has led to the motor vehicle standards that EPA has promulgated. In 2010, EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration finalized light-duty vehicle greenhouse gas emission standards and corporate average fuel economy standards for light-duty vehicles. And it was the first in a series of greenhouse gas regulations that EPA has begun promulgating for motor vehicles. And this is the second thing I want you to remember. The Clean Air Act and the Motor Vehicle Regulation Rule will result in significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. This is some work that our staff put together forecasting greenhouse gas emissions from transportation sources out to 2025, and as you can see, we turned the corner around 2005. Now, this is a combination of several things. It includes demographic changes, the dramatic changes that we've seen in the growth of vehicle miles traveled in Minnesota, transit options, and a few other things. But one of the major drivers here is the motor vehicle standards for greenhouse gas emissions. EPA originally promulgated new standards for new light-duty vehicles out to 2017. They have subsequently promulgated another set of standards for vehicles beyond 2017. And in 2011, they followed the light-duty vehicles with regulations for heavy-duty vehicles. Again, the first set of standards applied to the new vehicles in the model years 2014 through 2018. And if you read the paper today, you see that EPA is announcing they are going to come out with phase two of the heavy-duty vehicle standards that will apply beyond 2018, and the heavy-duty vehicle standards are significant because they represent 20% of the emissions from the transportation sector, even though they are a much smaller portion of the vehicles on the road. So, interestingly enough, regulating motor vehicles has led to EPA having the ability and the requirement to regulate stationary sources. In 2008, the administrator of the EPA wrote a memo that's been referred to as the Johnson memo that said, when a pollutant becomes a regulated, a pollutant becomes a regulated new source review pollutant, and that is a program that applies to stationary sources like factories and power plants, when a provision of the Act or regulations established under the Act require actual control of that pollutant. So thus, when the six greenhouse gases were regulated in January 2, 2011, because of the light duty vehicle rule, they became regulated pollutants under the Act, and they were then subject to stationary source pollution controls. And that's how EPA has led from going to this motor vehicle rule to rules for stationary sources. This program is called New Source Review, Prevention of Significant Deterioration. But essentially what it means is that once a pollutant is regulated, EPA is obligated to establish new source performance standards for stationary sources. So any new factory or any new power plant that gets built must comply with a certain set of standards. And those are generally thought of as technology standards or some sort of a emission rate that must be achieved. EPA has gone through the source sectors of sources that they could be regulating through this and initially identified power plants as the first target because they're the largest sector of greenhouse gas emissions. And then they secondarily identified refineries as the next sector that they would like to attack under this new source review rule requirement. At this point in time, the only activity that we've seen has been with power plants. Just recently, EPA has proposed standards of new performance for all fossil fuel electric utility steam generating units and combustion turbines. This was something that was promulgated earlier this year. It's going to be litigated. And the thrust of that is that for anyone that wants to build a new coal-fired power plant, they're going to have to essentially install carbon capture technology that captures the carbon in the stack and sequesters it in the ground somewhere. And the contention is that that's out there a little bit in terms of commercially available technology and that it's going to be cost prohibitive and that as a result we won't see any new coal-fired power plants built in this country. I don't know if that's really going to be the effect of the rule, but that's the complaint that many people are making. Once standards of performance for new sources are proposed, then EPA has to follow that with standards of performance for existing sources. And this is the third thing I want you to remember, because this affects us here in Minnesota. EPA is in the process of developing rules for existing coal-fired power plants. And this is referred to as Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. The number doesn't really matter. Just know that it's a performance standard that's going to apply to all of the facilities that are out there right now. Again, typically these would be technology-based standards that you have to install this doohickey on every unit in order to comply. But EPA is taking pre-input. They haven't even proposed a draft at this point. They're taking what I just referred to as pre-input. And they've indicated an interest and a willingness to try to be as flexible as possible in order to make this easier to implement and to make it more cost-effective. The president has asked them to propose a new rule by June 2014, so that would be June of this year, and to finalize that rule by June of 2015, and for states to be able to submit their plans to EPA that would become federally enforceable by June of 2016. There are a number of ways that we're getting input on this and that we have submitted input to EPA. As you know, we have reduced power plant emissions in Minnesota significantly, and we will continue to do so. Our estimates are that we've reduced emissions by about 22% to date, and are on track to reduce emissions in our power plants by around 33% by 2025. We've told EPA the kind of programs that are in place in Minnesota that are going to be helping to achieve that. That's one of the things that they asked for input on. We've told them that the rule should be flexible, that it should not necessarily apply stack by stack. It should allow more flexibility than that. For example, it should allow a utility to average its emissions at a minimum. It might even be better if we could average emissions statewide as opposed to just utility by utility. And others have even suggested that there be regional approaches to this that would be even further more efficient. We definitely want EPA to allow reductions from efforts that we've already taken to be creditable, and that would be counting renewables as well as repowering existing facilities and energy savings through energy efficiency activities. We've told EPA that they should consider the impacts on jobs, definitely protect citizens, and that we desperately need to have more than 1 year to put a plan together because it's not going to be possible to go through rulemaking in Minnesota in 1 year. And many other states are sharing that same comment.
David, does that comment protect citizens? What does that pertain to, health or rates or what?
Well, we want to make sure that as EPA lowers emissions over here, they don't cause emissions to rise over here. We want to make sure that they're taking a careful look at all communities and making sure that whatever they do is going to be equally protective and fair. That's the gist of the comment that we made on that.
So David, let me just clarify that, because when I talk about that, I talk about the disproportionate impact and the unintended consequence of measurable improvement in one sector, in one community, for example, while we're not seeing a proportionate reduction elsewhere. And equity is a part of that debate from a how the program gets implemented. So not that we know how that should be done at this point, but we're making the comment in these preliminary comments that it would be useful from a state perspective to not set up a program where the impacts of improvement are managed in a way that has consequences that are disproportionate. That's really what it comes down to from my chair, that the city is continuing to emit, for example, while rural areas are seeing better and better air quality. That would be a disproportionate impact. And we want to be able to address that as the program is unfolded, rather than saying, oh, well, now that we're 10 years down the road, we realize that we didn't think early about how those impacts were going to fall out in our communities. That's why we make that comment.
We are getting some input from stakeholders as we developed some initial comments to EPA, and as we follow EPA's development of this rule, and obviously we'll be commenting further. We have an unofficial stakeholder group that's been meeting for over 2 years, and we'll continue to work with them. The PCA, some Minnesota utilities, and a number of non-governmental organizations have been participating in something that's called the Midwestern Collaborative, and it's a group of Midwestern states that have been looking at how implementing this rule can be done in such a way so as not to disadvantage the Midwest, which is a little more reliant on coal and industries that are heavy users of electricity than other parts of the country. Initially, the states participating in this collaborative were Minnesota, Illinois, and Michigan, and we've been recently joined by Kentucky, and Wisconsin has joined as an observer. So I think we're beginning to get a little more diversity in the group of states that are participating in this, and that's helpful. And we've also been participating in a multi-state regulatory agency group that has been following EPA's work and commenting, and that primarily includes states on the East Coast and the West Coast, as well as Minnesota. I do want to mention one last thing. There's been a growing interest in considering the possibility of a regional approach to implementation of this rule that EPA will be proposing, with the notion that the more area and utilities and states that you can spread this out over, the more flexibility you'll have, and ultimately the less expensive the cost to implement it. Spreading a regulation that's designed for state by state over multiple states has a number of challenges, as you can imagine, but if the savings is big enough, and when I hear people are talking about billions and billions of dollars, then maybe there'll be a motivating factor in getting people to talk about this. So we'll be able to share more about that later, because not so much has happened to date. I'm done. Happy to answer any other questions, but there are three things that I wanted you to remember. The Clean Air Act was not made for doing this. It is, however, going to be effective in reducing motor vehicle emissions, and EPA is in the process of pursuing power plant emission reductions at this point in time, and we're going to have an opportunity to have further input on that.
Sure. Commissioner Rothman's joined us, and touch your button there so you're on. Thank you. And you're good. Wanted to just hear any comments you had about this, Commissioner.
Well, I just wanted to follow up and comment. First of all, I think my it says Dave Fredrickson there, so I didn't want any confusion. No, I'm just kidding. I was at and testified at Congress at Senator Franken's hearing, the Energy Subcommittee, last week, and it was about energy efficiency, renewable energy, and the question came up about 111D. So I was designated to take a swing at it, and thankfully I had the benefit of your thoughts and all of that in terms of flexibility and all of that. The one other let the record be clear, huh? But the one thing I did want to comment or add to that was that I felt it was very important that the EPA also build in, if we're going to go with renewables and energy efficiency, that there is the mechanism to measure energy efficiency, and the ability to collect that data is very important to be able to harness the information. And I thought it was well received by the committee, and I don't know if you have any comment about that, but I just wanted to share that the Senate Energy Committee was very attuned to the 111D process and to what the states felt were important in conveying that information to EPA and you know, how can they best, you know, implement the regulation.
David. You're absolutely right. And tracking and accounting for energy efficiency is probably going to be one of the trickier things that would have to be done along this flexibility path. EPA can easily promulgate a regulation that applies to a stack. They're used to doing it. We're used to implementing it. We're used to enforcing it. It's kind of easy, if not inflexible. These flexible approaches are going to have to come with some level of accountability and measurement. And one of the things that they're asking for a lot of comment on, and that a lot of states are thinking about right now, is how you would actually credit these things and make sure that a ton is a ton and there's equivalency between the different kinds of systems. So that's a very good point.
Any other questions? If not,
John.
Yeah, Brian.
I'm just curious. The state of Minnesota, the citizens of Minnesota this winter recently experienced some shortages of propane that have caused a lot of pain across the state, and thankfully the Department of Commerce has stepped in and tried to relax regulations, and that's very much appreciated. When you discuss the rules and the time frame for implementing those rules, it appears, well, I guess I'm not sure how the rules would be implemented, but if utilities aren't able to comply with those new rules in that time frame, could we wind up having a shortage of electricity similar to that which we've seen with propane this year and a commensurate spike in electric rates? Because as I questioned earlier, was that protect citizens, was that pertaining to health, or was it a rate spike? It appears that there could be an opportunity here for a shortage next go round, instead of propane, electrical.
That's another great point. One of the things that EPA is being lectured on as they take input on this is system reliability. And one of the things that has interested the conversation about a regional multi-state approach to implementation is the notion that it would improve system reliability across the region as opposed to a stack-by-stack, state-by-state approach. So, and Mr. Grant may have some things to say to that when he comes up later, but people are paying attention to that concern and are watching what EPA talks about and thinks about with that in mind.
Let me also just touch base generally on this as well. Specifically for Minnesota, the propane situation is distinguishable in itself. It's an unregulated market. We're really dependent upon market forces, and it's an area where prices and supply just went off the radar screen here. Not off the radar screen, but went off the charts. And so, but if you go into the electrical and your coal, the generation capacity, you really have to dig down into Minnesota in terms of what is our generation capacity, what fleets do we have in terms of all of the generation capacity. In Minnesota, we've seen a migration from coal-based plants to natural gas plants, and the ones that are being developed in the resource planning through the PUC and the Department of Commerce are really guided by not only just reliability, but what is can be accomplished and what's the best for Minnesota consumers. So you do have to factor in what's happening, obviously, with the EPA, but we're in Minnesota, I think, we can take credit for his being ahead of the game a little bit. We are trying to do what we can and work with the utilities with their resource planning to switch it from coal to natural gas. And, we're, of course, we'll have to engage and have these conversations with EPA and take into account all this stuff. But I think the overall goal is to hopefully get to a better place with our environment.
And, David, maybe we should just send out a copy of the letter that we sent to EPA on the 111D rule to all the board members. But for my sake, one of the comments that we tried to make in that letter was that Minnesota's approach is more of a systems, whole systems approach on the mix of energy and sources and production capacity, ratepayers, ability to pay, and then protection of the environment and human health. That systems-based approach has fit our interest very well. And we've managed with the utilities, with the energy utilities, to make the shift gradually enough that ratepayers have been considered in decision-making, and the impacts of fuel sources and improvements, air quality improvements, all other sorts of efforts over the years have been manageable. And we are seeing improvements in our air emissions. We're seeing we last year noted significant reductions in mercury emissions across Minnesota because of the shift from coal to natural gas, as well as just the diversification of renewable energy systems across the state have added capacity that would have otherwise been met through some more environmentally damaging approach. So I think when we made that comment to the EPA, our goal was have that systems-based approach with the ratepayers' ability to, you know, manage any costs considered in the decision making. Kate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question that's sort of two parts, and it could be asked here potentially on number three. But part of it is here. So my understanding is that our biggest utility, Xcel, and maybe others, but that's the one I'm most aware of, is sort of in, as it's going through resource planning, there's sort of a natural cycle of reinvestment in electricity production, and kind of that's how rates are driven in many ways. And so my understanding is that Xcel is kind of ramping up to one of those bigger reinvestment times, which is regardless of climate change regulation would likely be increasing rates. So I have a question about how those will be sort of sussed out and how that'll be made clear. And I think that might be a better question for Bill Grant. But for David, the question I had is, how do you see the sort of timeline of the federal climate change regulations mapping on to the reinvestment in our electricity production infrastructure, and is it going to be too slow, or are the decisions going to be already made? How I mean, I'm sure they're very aware of what's happening, but if you could just give some context on that, that could be helpful thinking in a very Minnesota-specific impacts of this federal regulation.
Well, I'll start, and then I think Bill, when he gets up here, probably can follow on with that. There are some actions underway right now with respect to specific coal-fired units that, if made quickly and hastily, would not have the benefit of what EPA's regulation might require in the decision process. And it may be beneficial to have that information at hand before making a decision that could mean investment in a unit for another 35 years or 30 years, or making a different investment. So while the timelines are not perfectly in sync, I think they're close enough that we ought to think about whether we want to take a breath here and wait for EPA's rule to come out and take advantage of that information before we make a bunch of big decisions.
Thank you, David. Let's move on to Ellen's presentation on the EQB climate change framework document.
John, if I could.
Yes, Dave.
I just want to acknowledge Natalie Hoydahl is sitting out here. And for those of you that were at our board meeting last January, stand up and wave, Natalie, so everyone can see you. You know, we've had this long relationship with the Minnesota Environmental Network and the Environmental Congress. And, Kate, I believe you made the motion that we continue that relationship with them. And, John, I believe you were the seconder of the motion. And so I'm so pleased to see you here in the chair today, and particularly as you listen in on this discussion regarding climate change. So I just wanted to acknowledge you and tell you how important it is for you to be here.
Thank you, Commissioner. And welcome, Ellen, and I assume we'll introduce John and Liz.
I will do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chairs, how's that? So I was going to start by reviewing the past couple of years of activity, and Commissioner Stein, you did that already, as did Will Seufert. So I won't really go through that, but I think just in brief, just to say again that we are here because of a long process of activity that the EQB has embarked on over the last couple of years, including, as you said, the Environmental Congress, the Next Generation Congress, the planning workshops, with the Governor's Institute, and so this is part of that process. And so in late summer, following on the planning workshop with the Governor's Institute on community design, we started putting together a proposal, which I've talked to you about a little bit pretty much every month, briefly, and so that's what we want to talk about today, is what is the progress that we're making on our framework, on our climate change framework, which we see as really the first step in the EQB taking on an active role in climate change planning and activity. And so what we did was create a new interagency steering committee and tried to merge some of the existing committees that were already active in state government. So we have a very robust group of state agency staff that have a lot of expertise, as well as a writing team that have been working with us to compile information that is the foundation for this framework. We've prepared a very extensive rough draft, which has a great deal of data and information in it, and conveyed that to the Haberman firm. And I will introduce them in just a moment and let them talk to you, but I just want to give the background. So, as a reminder, the starting point for all of this work is the state greenhouse gas reduction goals in statute, which call for a 15% reduction by 2015, 30% reduction by 2025, and 80% reduction by 2050. And I think David made the point here that we are making tremendous progress in some particular sectors on reaching our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And he pointed out fuel efficiency standards and what an impact that's made. Of course, that was instigated by the federal government. But a lot of things have also been instigated by us and by the state of Minnesota and many, many participants in the state. The electricity sector, David mentioned, has already reduced emissions some 22% in that same time frame that we're measuring. But overall, we know that economy-wide, which is what these goals refer to, we've only reduced emissions about 3%. So we know that we're not on track to meet our 2015 goals and that it's urgent for us to take action. So that's the basic premise of the work that we're starting now. And so to describe what this report entails and will involve very briefly, it's intended to be a progress report that will lay out that challenge and the urgency of that challenge that I just described. It will talk specifically about some of the risks of inaction and some of the benefits of taking leadership on this issue, especially in the area of clean energy development and what that could bring to our state's economy. And it's going to report on and explain what our state is doing and the progress that we have made and the progress that our state agencies are making in many, many activities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to adapt to climate change and make our state more resilient and prepared for the impacts of climate change. So both mitigation and adaptation. And this report, this framework, will assess and report progress towards meeting the state goals while getting all of the state government and all of us on the same page, moving in the same direction towards the same goal. And so putting that unified information together has really not been done before. And so we intend with this framework to lay the foundation for climate action, for the next steps of climate action, for further emissions reduction, and further action on adaptation. And we're going to hear more about that today. And Bill's presentation will follow on to that, about what are some of the next steps that we need to do to take action and to complete this job that we are beginning. And so this framework will identify, it will look to the past, but it will also look to the future. And it will identify some of the key pieces and strategies that will be needed and that are already underway for a climate action plan, but also identify that there's a lot more work that's needed and more action needed. So we're very lucky to have the help and support of this fabulous team from the Haberman firm, and we have two of the key key people here today who I'll introduce in just a moment. another preview. But I just want to repeat that we have the help. We're very grateful to the help from the McKnight Foundation to have their help. Excuse me. And the goal that we have laid out with the Haberman team is to transform all this information into a user-friendly, shorter document that the EQB can use to launch a dialogue with Minnesotans and with key stakeholders about climate change. The timeline, briefly, is that over the next month or two, we hope to have an actual document to give you. We've forwarded to you, Will sent to you just a few days ago or late last week, a draft summary, an executive summary of that. This is Haberman's work, and an outline of what the framework and report will look like. And this is, as always, an evolving document, and we really are interested in your input, your feedback, your questions, and hopefully you've had a chance to review that that draft in the last few days. And we can have some discussion about that today as you are interested in doing so. So with that, I'd like to introduce, on my far right is John Zerbe, who's a partner from Haberman, and Liz Otto is our chief writer, copywriter and editor, editor-in-chief for this project. And so we're really, really fortunate to have their incredible talents helping us on this project. So who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Great.
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you for having us today. As Ellen did a great job of describing where we are with this document, just to give you a little background on Haberman, we are a marketing agency, and we are modern storytellers for pioneers. So we tell the stories of people and businesses that are making a difference in the world. And so this is a real honor to tell this story. One of the things that we do very well at Haberman is to simplify complex topics and to engage the public in stories that matter to them. And our job is to distill a lot of complicated and complex material into a document that people will understand so that they care about the impacts and the costs of climate change, the costs of inaction, and also the bright and promising opportunities we have before us when we talk about clean energy and some of the other things that we're doing with energy efficiency here in Minnesota. So it's a mighty task. And we've had a lot of help from people here before us, and there's several people behind us that have already given us a lot of great information to work with. I have the dubious honor of looking at 86 pages and figuring out how to get that down to about 30. John is small font. See, and this is these are the suggestions we're looking for today. Wide margins, small font.
Big paper.
Right. We tell stories in words, and we tell stories with color and with pictures. And so in a moment, John will tell you a little bit about where we are at with our design of this document. We wanted to share some exciting mood boards, and we'll get to that in a moment. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to look at the documents that Will sent you, but I do come before you today asking, as Ellen said, for questions and feedback. But one of the questions I had for you is, if you were to imagine that this document was published and was wildly successful, and you saw Ellen in the hallway about a year from now, and you told her, I am so glad we did this, and I'm so glad we're having this conversation with the public, and it's working. I would like you to let me know, a few of you or all of you, what would it be that you would say to her if you said, I'm so glad we included that one thing. That one thing made the difference. Or that particular message was most important, and I'm really glad that we got it in there. And so we're really far down our path, but this is a fabulous moment for us to come before you and have an answer to that question. So we're sure to get your thoughts before we continue on. So I'll pass it over to you.
And I'll start, since I did think about that a little bit.
Good.
I really think that part three of the document is the sort of the segue from am I duty bound, am I guilty, or am I opportunistic about our future. I think that is this a win-win for Minnesota, for a stronger economy and for a healthier environment and public health? If I were able to say, I'm really glad that we engaged the citizens of Minnesota on that issue, I would consider it a success, because I feel like so much of the debate that we have in my world and environmental regulatory world is I'm duty bound or I'm somehow guilty or should be considered guilty for something that I should have known better and avoided doing. And so I want to turn that from a negative story about climate and about climate change and greenhouse gases and our future to a more positive story. And that would be the one, if I had to say, really turned our future around, would be on that subject. Tom.
John and Liz and John and Ellen and I visited before this, and I had some specific thoughts about this. I want to take us back a little bit because we got to remember how we got to today, you know, and retrace a little bit of it. But out of the work that we have done over the last couple of years, we have concluded that climate change is one of those things that the EQB can wrestle with and deal with and be the coordinator for. But it presumes that something comes out of that. We aren't just going to sit here and deliberate and navel gaze and do something. We want some actions taken, right? So when I look at this, this is our communications piece to the public that sort of gets to that desired outcome. That desired outcome is we want Minnesotans to demand specific actions to be taken of the agencies, right? So when I think about this document, I think, that's the outcome we want. So the purpose of this document, you know, we have to be very explicit about it. We want this document to, you know, I think Ellen and Liz both said we want to start the conversation with Minnesotans, but we want this to be the communication that engages people enough that they really do kind of rise up and demand that we do something. If we don't have the public support to implement, we're not going to get the funding or the authorities to do the things that we need either for adaptation or for mitigation. And so I think it has to paint the picture of the scenario, as I called with Ellen, situation analysis, where we are today. And certainly we have to have that, but I think we have to have some direction about what we want the people to ask us to do. And it can't just be deal with climate change. That can't be what people ask us to do. They must say things like, we want you to increase the renewable fuel standards. We want you to increase the amount of acres being planted into carbon sequestering grasses or trees or something. I think it has to be a little more specific. And maybe if this document can't do that, and I see that part seven actually is what's next, we have to be pretty explicit in part seven that what we're going to do next. If we're not going to propose in here what we're going to do in terms of dealing with climate change, then we have to advise people that, okay, now we're going to get to that level of planning, right? So I think we have to be really clear that this is the document that we're going to use as a communications piece that's going to engage the citizens to demand us to rise up and do the right thing. And if this doesn't say exactly what that's going to be, then we have to let people know that that's what the next document is. That's
excellent.
Going to be the
excellent.
Specific.
Thank you.
Other comments, board members? Kate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's great that that we have professional storytellers coming in to help us tell this story. As someone who
Davis.
Who works with a lot of Dave has a certain style.
works in Murdoch.
Oh, that's kind of you, Kate. Thank you. Yes.
And I appreciate it. I learned a lot with his, you know, we all told a little bit of our personal stories today, and I thought that was great. And I think it is, I work with a lot of scientists who don't get why people aren't, like, completely freaked out about this and kind of bang their heads against the wall, but don't, and they spend a lot of money getting the science right and not as much time or effort helping people understand it. Mm-hmm. And if you look at kind of what work made impact, the communications part really needs to be up there. So I think this is right on, and I think McKnight is smart about thinking in terms of supporting it, and I think we have the right partners at the table. If I was out looking a year back, one, it would be that if some of the non-traditional networks knew about this, And so not the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. Not they're the ones that are at this meeting. But if, you know, the ask MSP or
the greater
MSP, mm-hmm. and they have this social media campaign right now asking what is the Twin Cities, what is, and I know this is bigger than the Twin Cities, but that would be a network that's asking some big mm-hmm. questions about who we should be and where we're going. And if climate change is not on their agenda after this, then we've probably done something wrong. And the bee pollen kind of group is partnering with that. The Bush mm-hmm. Foundation yeah, yeah. is really yeah. Seeding a lot of that work. And they're regional in terms of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the tribal communities in that same area. So they're maybe a non-traditional environmental network. So if there's some traction, if the people who aren't usually at the table are talking about this, and that's partially how does this document look, and it's who are we reaching out to get input and buy-in and also see that, I think, would be a game changer in this conversation in a way we haven't mm-hmm. we've seen glimpses of in the last 5 to 10 years, but we haven't totally seen. Mm-hmm. So I would be excited if we could say that we saw that. I don't quite know how to do that, but hopefully you can help figure that out.
We're working on that already. Yeah. But that is the challenge. And so we've had discussions with people who are in the agencies in the trenches doing this work and really pushing them again and again. You know, we've got to boil down what you're doing in bite-sized pieces, because that's the only way we can get people to understand and actually tell stories around that. And that's one thing that maybe didn't show up in the outline, but one of the things that we want to do is to pair action that's been taken in Minnesota with stories, success stories, and stories of people that are making changes in Red Wing and seeing success in Minneapolis and seeing the state of Minnesota leading by example, so that people aren't just looking at charts and statistics. And that's really where there's a shift in our thinking about how we talk about this. And they're looking at summaries that summarize the facts and show what we've done, but also make the case that we have to take this very seriously and we need to act now, and why. And sometimes the best way to do that is through stories of people that they can relate to, businesses that are impacted, significantly impacted by climate change and need us to all take action. So that's also a part of that. That's one of the responses to your suggestion, and that's where we're focusing some of our attention.
Kristen.
I think that there's just a fundamental, this is actually one of my other lives, Mythos Institute did a lot of story work, and there's just such a fundamental capacity of human beings to trigger their care and action by the kind of identification that traditional stories allow us to make mm-hmm. with, you know, flowers and species. And as Minnesotans, there are certain species and certain plants with which we actually have a bond and we identify. I hope this doesn't sound too strange, but and I think that was, there was so much response to the duck story, Minnesota ducks. The editorial was extremely moving to people, and there was lots of response. The monarchs I see flying all over my emails. And so I think that this really human story is a fundamental human technology, and to bring that on is very, very powerful and exciting. And maybe there are opportunities, too, to network and connect and engage the other storytellers in our culture, you know, mm-hmm. media, actually literally storytellers, yeah. You know, the storytelling in the schools. So anyway, I think it's really exciting. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Rothman, then Commissioner Fredrickson.
Well, I'll do it. I've been trying to convince my wife for years that I should own a new Harley-Davidson, and so far my pleas have fallen on deaf ears. So if you could help me with that story, reducing my greenhouse gas with the new Harley, I would appreciate it.
I'll be available in a couple months. Once we're done, we'll talk.
My eight-year-old wants me to buy a motorcycle, too, and take him on a ride. It's not worth
critical
it.
Mass. If we can get more motorcycle buyers out there,
my wife
then we can
insists,
put a report together.
My wife insists that I Should not do that.
But, Vespa.
Well, you know, you ask a very important question, and it's fundamental, I think, to the success of what we're doing, the success of the work of the subcommittee, the work of the EQB as a whole. And it's a very difficult task given all of the layers that we're dealing with in terms of, you know, local politics, state politics, regional politics, global politics. And I often ask myself, too, and we've, I think we started this way as EQB members, as stewards right now of the responsibilities we have in the state, not only just for us as EQB members, but as people in Minnesota, how do we take on that responsibility and leave for the next generation better off than what we had it? And today we have the youth that are participating with us, and we have children, and we have to say to ourselves, you know, how can we answer to them if we should have done something today in order to mitigate something tomorrow? You look at the politics of hurricanes, Sandy. You have flooding in Minnesota. You have all of these issues that are going on. And we can't say to ourselves that this isn't happening, that we have to do something in order to achieve these things. And I do want to, and I want to commend to all of us, while we can accomplish certain things and have, for example, the 22% reduction in the greenhouse gas reduction on electricity side, there are bigger things that we can do in addition to that, in the energy side, but also in other areas, and to spell those out for people. I often go back to some of the sessions that we had on the Environmental Congress. When you're sitting at the tables and people are saying, you know, I've never seen things like monarchs, this happening to the impact to us, or even possums, or the fact that when we come out with the mapping that shows our forests are migrating north and further north, and 10, 20 years from now, our entire forests are going to be different than what they are today. You know, how do we make sure that citizens are engaged? And I want to concur with my colleagues and say, look, we need, in some sense, to make sure we have a call to action somewhere. How do you motivate people to really understand that this is an issue of our time that we need to do things about? What is that connection? I know stories are, and when you speak, those are very important to talk about stories. And how do we do that? We can talk about the stories of weather. We can talk about stories, you know, of each of the impacts on our animals and the agriculture sector and all of that. But I think how we need it's a very daunting task to boil all of this down and to come up with some sort of, you know, bite-sized information that says to people, when you read this document, it means we have to do something, and we need to do it today rather than tomorrow. And to achieve that in so many different ways. And I do like the idea of being very specific about what this document is. And then if there's something different, if there's more work to be done, what is that work to be done so that we are we're engaging with the public honestly about the expectations and what we really want to do and what we want to achieve with it so that we can continue the process and to be able to say, okay, well, now these are the action items, these are the things that we have to do, and these are how we have to achieve them. It's a tough task, but we're glad you're with us, and we appreciate all the effort that you're working on.
Thank you.
Thanks. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to piggyback on what was just said, but also double back to where we began, that the tone that leaves or that people walk away with is really positive. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that demotivates people is it seems so impossible. And so stories, I was just thinking about a Habitat of Humanity house at zero net whatever energy, zero. That's an affordable house. I mean, that house was built with minimal dollars and zero net. So it means it's doable. I mean, I think people need to walk away from the document thinking, we can do this, not just the big policy, but each one of us as individuals, we can do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric.
I think
Sandy, I want to expand, and thank you for bringing up housing, because I'm sitting here trying to think of the what is a single common denominator that people across all demographics, you know, marketing, generally, you have your target market. But in this campaign, you have the state of Minnesota, every citizen. Mm-hmm. What's the common denominator? And telling a story, I think everybody may be able to relate to housing. Mm-hmm. Most people have housing or striving to obtain housing, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And if you can show that there are things that, yeah, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll just leave it at that, because, you know.
Well, you bring up a great point that that's one of the things that we need to use as our lens when we look at the text are to find common denominators. And that's a huge point, and I'm really, really glad that you brought that up. Housing is one. We can relate the weather story. That's a common denominator. And so that's one of the criteria we use when trying to decide what gets into the document and is emphasized in a certain way so that we can have everybody on the same page. And I hadn't thought of housing in that way, so I'm very glad that you brought that up.
Yeah. Yep. I would add also, you know, relative to housing, but to think beyond, I mean, there's a strong sense of place for Minnesotans that thematically, you know, can draw into a couple different areas. And so how those stories through that sense of place and pride that we have in Minnesota, and we were talking about just the information or the photos or what those stories are that we find unique opportunity for people to not only understand what others are doing, but to see themselves in those stories as well, and making sure there's a broad cross-section, you know, across demographics, psychographics, to add on maybe even to Kate's point of just the approachability, and we'll get a little bit, this also can happen through design, but in part that this document has to be approachable for the first time. There's been a bevy and plenty of reports that have been published this far that have been posted to the website. There are, you know, for people to go find and click through and try to make their way through it. But our charge, with you is to really figure out and produce something that is approachable, that people are going to want to take the time to engage in that further dialogue because they see themselves in it. They feel pride for what we've done thus far and are excited about taking action for the future.
I know we've got some boards to share, but I want to give board members an opportunity to speak up. And Ed, I know you had your hand up. And
just one thought, you know, I agree with all of these comments, but one is we have to convince people, why should they care? Yep. Why is this an issue? And the two things that I know that I think people really care about are their jobs and their health. And I think people don't recognize that climate change will have a huge impact on health. Mm-hmm. All of the indicators, I mean, people die from what's going on, and people are getting sick from what's going on. And it changes, you talk about community, it changes how people interact with each other, mm-hmm. and it'll change the quality of life in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I think that people have to recognize that it will have a direct impact on the economy, which affects them, and it's going to have an impact on their health and the impact on their community.
Thank you. John.
Mr. Chair, we've talked today about the next generation and our commitment to them as a board. And I look at this table and I see that most of us are probably from the baby boom generation. And I just would like to emphasize that the story you might tell to us might be different than the younger generation, the generational matrix, mm-hmm. that they communicate differently, they're motivated by different things. And they're probably the people that are most important in what's happening here. So I would emphasize keeping that in mind as you tell the story. Mm-hmm. Which generation are you telling the story mm-hmm. to? Or everybody. Mm-hmm. Of course, mm-hmm. that makes it very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tom.
Thanks. Sandy said something that got me thinking about this with respect to, you know, we got to provide some hope. You know, the unfortunate reality is the response time to mitigation measures is so long that we're not going to see the return to a normal climate in our lifetimes, maybe not in the lifetimes of the millennials. And so somehow we have to ensure that people understand when they look at this that, you know, mitigation measures must be done, even though you're not going to see any benefit from it in your lifetime. And in order to deal with the inevitable fact that we are going to see climate change, we have to begin these adaptation strategies that are going to give us a different environment 50 years from now, 100 years from now, because that's the reality we're going to have. So somehow we're going to have to provide that message to people that, you know, this is not a war we're going to win in a lifetime. Things are going to look different 50 years from now. And so we have to, on the one hand, do mitigation strategies that we're not going to see the benefit of, and they're going to cost us a lot of money, but at the same time invest in the adaptation strategies because we have to recognize that change is coming. So it's a I hadn't thought about that till I started reflecting on what you said, Sandy, and the fact is it's kind of a tough message to sell. We are not giving the next generation a better place. We're giving them a worse place. We're giving them a commitment to try and changing that around, but that might not come until the generation after that.
Mike, did you have some? Brian.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think a lot of great points have been made. The challenge of your question was the discussion with somebody 12 months from now. And as has been pointed out, these are changes we won't see in our lifetime. And your document you described as a document that was going to more or less describe success stories. This happened to me, or this is why you should pay attention. I think you almost have to throw in some stories that are more forecasting the future. Mm-hmm. Not this is what happened to me, more this is what will happen to you. If you enjoy the boundary waters today, here's what your trip will look like in 40 years. The change in the forest, change in the water levels, change in the wildlife habitat. Because it's going to be very difficult to come up with stories that show a measurable change in somebody's life in 12 months or do something that you say in 12 months, boy, am I glad you included that because otherwise this wouldn't have been a valuable document mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. I think you really have to forecast, and you have to forecast different instances, whether it's a farmer using irrigation or somebody paddling in the boundary waters or somebody driving to work. What is going to change for them? What's life going to look like 40 years from now? Because what we're really doing is we're selling a concept that's going to take many, many years to come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you asked a good question because a lot of people had things to say. And Commissioner Fredrickson is now depressed. Let the record show. Let's move on, John. You had
You know, we touched on it, and so to jump in, what we also have today, and I can bring up some boards and pull it up on the screen. But is just key to the discussion with the data, the numbers, the stories is certainly the visual presentation and the visual display of information, if you will, being key to consumers, the general public, you know, understanding what we're talking about and match with photos. And so continuing to work with the subcommittee, but we do have to share kind of design directions, if you will. We refer to them as mood boards, two distinct, that give you a feel and a flavor for how we maybe start to visualize some of the aspects coming together. And so we're sharing that in process today for, you know, any quick feedback, but knowing that the document itself will really come to light once we have the content, you know, being final, and we start to work with the final graphs, the final numbers, and the like. So, if you want to pass it up, but I can take a double click here. So in front of you, the first concept we have, and so to back up a mood board just for context is, what does it start to maybe feel and look like? What are the colors, the palettes that we would start to explore? And so we have in front of you is we've termed internally as bright. What we've heard very much is the notion that we want to feel energy, positive, pride, and to kind of create a look and feel, a tone that very much, in fact, communicates that kind of across the board. And so this palette also draws a little bit of inspiration from the EQB itself and maybe the circular seal, but you start to see very much how that type of theme can play through. And so a quick translation that you'll also see, how does this start to feel a little bit, again, just in concept only, is presented here. We do believe, again, the use of photos, the color, the graphics very much will be key and critical, knowing that those photos, these are kind of placeholder, if you will, but very much need to and absolutely be from Minnesota itself, that we're not pulling images that are kind of stock and could be anywhere. But the degree that we can start to draw people into actual imageries, photos from Minnesota is very much key. That is the first one. And then, so then secondly, the second version, a little more organic, kind of referred as Earth, getting at certainly climate change does speak to environment. I think we looked at ourselves and said, is there a way to communicate this visually somehow without the kind of traditional green and blue? Certainly that those exist, but a more organic maybe take on a look and feel that has a kind of quiet, humble, but also sophisticated maybe approach to the creative. And so this here again is just a representation of how that comes to life. Two distinct, and certainly there are opportunities within each that we feel very good about that we could bring forth and actually use in production to lay out all the content. And I think importantly, as you really get into the graphics, the data, the information, to start to bring forth that content in a much different way, and not rely on extended copy blocks, rely on paragraphs that are, you know, three sentences deep with numerous data points within, that visually, beyond the colors, beyond everything that we're doing, storytelling through visuals is going to be critical to this. And so we're in the early stages of just identifying how we want to start to tackle that as Liz here works closely with Ellen and the rest of the agencies to refine that content, and then we build the visual package around it. So.
And it will not be in Latin, the final report, just FYI.
It only limits your audience.
Yeah.
I like the more organic look myself. I mean, it's a personal preference, the bright, but I think you got to think about what was said earlier about the generations that we're aiming at.
Yeah.
I want to be sensitive to that, but my nature says go to that more organic feel.
This is why we have co-chairs. The tone and mood to me was good when you have that hope and brightness to it. So I don't. Yeah. I kind of go back and forth, but I also like the organic approach because that conveys some honesty and, you know, naturalness mm-hmm. to it as well. But
yeah, and I think
you guys are the experts. Yep. I mean, you got to. Yep. What's the best way to engage your audience?
Yeah, and I think we certainly have started to have discussions internally and informed opinions, and we're going to come back with a strong recommendation. I think today we're here to show you where we're at, make sure you guys feel comfortable, see tonality. Visually, kind of thematic direction where we can take this. Both definitely are very serviceable, but pushing towards, again, a recommendation that undoubtedly we'll share with the broader team, but both have opportunity here as well.
Anything else, Ellen, or great?
That's really all today. You know, maybe just one quick point, and that is that all the information that we're compiling it's very weighty. There's a lot of really good content in it, and it will not be lost, even though we're going to have a shorter version. So I just want to remind you of all of that we'll have layers here. And we hope this will all end up on the EQB website as a really easily accessible each layer, the shortest version, the framework, and then the deep information for those who want to follow it. And hopefully that will be of value to all of you in your agencies. Some of your agencies already have a lot of this on their websites, and some don't. And so I think it'll be useful information for those who care to dig in deeper. So all that work is of value.
And I would just, I would add, we're honored and excited to help and be part of this process, in part jumping in and seeing what also is happening in other reports that have been created across the nation, whether it's at a state level, city level, and really the opportunity for us to take this moment in time to create something that's different, that is propped up there, and that others can point to as maybe a model for engaging consumers and presenting information this way. There certainly are some good things out there, but I would say there's also an opportunity for the collective us here to look at this as an opportunity to present the information and do it a little bit differently as maybe a model for others as well, because a lot of it gets really heavy, pretty deep, and just not as approachable as we would deem necessary to really engage the conversation with the consumers. And so to that end, there's definitely a challenge, but we're no doubt excited about it, and it's something that we do every day, and we very much hope that it's something that others beyond the state look at as well for guidance in their efforts.
Well, we do. We're Minnesotan. We want to be better than average.
Better than average.
Ed, and then Brian.
When I looked at those two color palettes usually try to, how do they all match together? How do they complement each other? And then, so the first one I thought, you know, it's a lot more moist, and the other one is really actually felt reminded me of desert. And it just struck me, though, I consider, instead of having a palette that is complementary, having one that is contrast, because what I see, mm-hmm. the environment changing, that we're going to have extremes. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have all wet or all dry. We're going to have extremes, and we're going to have marked variations. So I'm wondering if the color palette may not reflect emotionally that those real contrasts that are going to be in our environment.
Brian.
Regarding the colors, I was struck by how vibrant everything is on the computer screen versus paper. Right. Mm. We're going to have a report out a year from now, and I'm assuming this is going to be a printed report, but it's also going to be available on websites.
Yep.
You're a marketing organization.
Mm-hmm.
What do you view as the total audience for this product? You know, we've got 5 million people in the state, or 20% of the state going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are the percentages that are going to see it in paper versus online? Because, you know, as we talked about, we were talking about mobile apps here earlier. A year from now, I just wonder how many people are really going to be doing anything that's not on an iPad or a tablet or a PC. So the colors on the screen were all pretty vibrant, really.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so can you maybe just address what is the target audience size and what is the target for paper versus online?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would be hard-pressed to get into numbers on audience size. I mean, certainly we're looking for, you know, the public to drive and view it. I think in part that gets to a discussion beyond the actual report itself and what we're doing to promote and communicate that more broadly. Again, this is simply a document and a tool to engage in the conversation. If we create it even in printed or web form, and it is a PDF that just lives on the EQB website, and there's not anything happening around it to drive attention to, whether it's through the media, individualized efforts through the agencies, or broader discussions, outreach, you know, by the state itself, then again, I think it's just another report. And as we get into it, we've started to have this conversation. I would say that, again, this is a consolidation of information that becomes presentable. But the bigger conversation definitely is, what is the communications aspect of it to the conversation that was had early in our discussion of just how do we go to market, if you will, with this information, and what do we learn from what we've done in the past. Relative to print and online, I know there's a discussion right now. Certainly the EQB is looking at enhancing its online presence, and we had a preliminary conversation thus far of how does this translate not just to a PDF on the website, but what opportunity exists for that online property that would be accessible via mobile to engage or present that information in that fashion that is even interactive, right? Your ability to drill down into particular topics, learn more, and click through, you know. There will be a time and place for print, but undoubtedly through the various communications and efforts, the call to action is going to be to drive people to this, and it's likely not going to be to pick it up in hard copy format, that we're going to be pushing them to an online platform, and ideally it would be something other than just linking to a PDF of it, that we find we take the content that's here that comes in this report. We're only going to be able to do so much down to 30 pages, so where's the opportunity on the website or online as well to drill down further into the great work that's happening in the agencies to expand further in the data and or create a more kind of dynamic environment for consumers to kind of interact with the data itself. So,
thanks. I think we'll take Charlie, then Kate, and then we got to move on. Okay, Charlie.
And then Charlie again, and then Kate. Yeah. I really love this idea of stories and what it is that Minnesotans really care about. And, you know, the best way to the brain is to the heart. Mm-hmm. And this has to have some emotion. I mean, you know, I'm the transportation guy. I suddenly realized, you know, we don't have pictures of bridges and concrete guardrail, as fascinating as those really are, you know, to many of us. But it's where it's the destination. It's where you're going. Yeah. And so I like the idea of bright or something that kind of catches the imagination. But if there were kind of a story in the pictures, you know, maybe not a windmill versus a smokestack, but and maybe just the beautiful, you know, stream and what it is we really value. But I would also kind of go to livability and make it urban and country. But also if there's a person there, if you could see yourself in the picture.
Yeah.
So it's not just an empty landscape, but where's the where's Tom fishing or whatever you guys do? You know, but I think it has to be that
absolutely.
The graphics have to kind of say what it is that Minnesotans really care about. And that's and it's threatened. I mean, it's like, wow, we don't want to lose that. And maybe it's not for us. It's our getting back to this generational thing. For those of us who are parents or grandparents, I mean, you know, our friends, you know, we as Minnesotans will come together for others. So I think that has to be graphically part of the...
Kate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the comments on colors and mood and feel. It's, I think, the first time I've ever had a conversation like this at a state on a group that sort of looks like this and doing government work. And so the one thing that I haven't, that keeps coming up into my brain is thinking about when do people automatically engage on climate change? And for better or worse, it has in the last few years been in sort of these dramatic representation, these dramatic embodiments of climate change. So Hurricane Sandy, currently it's the drought in California. It's the fact that Minnesota has had emergency declarations for both drought and flooding in the same year, sometimes in the same counties. And not to freak people out with this, but the question I would ask, and I don't have the answer to this, is how could this be useful when people are begging for this kind of information? And how could you make it more accessible at those kind of key moments when the when we're not forcing the conversation, when the conversation is forced on us, and how are we going to be responsive to it through this document or communication? Or I'm not quite sure. I hope that we don't have to be responsive to it, but I think the last couple of years have shown us that we have to be. And so it's a little way to flip it, and it, I think it's just a good question to kind of ask along the way. Is I'm not sure how to answer it, but hopefully you guys can at least think through
it. Yeah, and I think it goes back to that this, what's before us is not creating a document. It is definitely something bigger. And so while we are in showing color palettes and having that conversation, and that's part of it, everything that we do and will continue to do together has to be through that broader lens, versus a creative exercise, a writing exercise. And that's not our perspective and lens. That's definitely what we will do and help, but continue to work alongside with you guys to continue to take a more strategic approach to this dialogue and conversation beyond the document itself.
Thank you. And I just want to wrap this by, for people who were not able to be at the Governor's Institute conversations, we just sort of restarted that whole why. I mean, Kate, your statement was really good. It's sort of refreshing my mind. This is why. Yeah. Because people will come looking for answers. And it is really sort of fell to us. I hate to say it that way. It's really, I don't want to sound irresponsible, but it does fall on the who else but the Environmental Quality Board. This is sort of the conversation we had in our Governor's Institute. So we just had a very quick synopsis of it. Thank you very much. That was great. Now we're going to shift gears and move to our conversation with Bill Grant. Thank you very much, Ellen.
Thank you,
John and Liz, for being here. Bill is going to has the last two items for us, and we are going to be wrapped up at 4 o'clock, so we'll try to let Bill get through his presentations. Considered a failing of my career if that happens.
And you'll never get it because you'll never get a helmet law in this state. That would be a good picture.
Thank you.
You ready, Mr. Chairman?
Go forward, Bill. Sorry, I'm just looking at this.
Thank you. Bill Grant, Schreiber High School, Port Washington, New York.
Class
of 75.
Which city? Where?
Port Washington, New York.
Really? 75. I was a 76 grad. All right. We're contemporaries.
About that. So, what I'd like to do in the next couple of minutes, Mr. Chair and members, is update you on the next phase after the phase we just talked about of the work that we're doing on climate under the auspices of the EQB. And many of you will remember, advance the slides, that in 2007-2008, a number of stakeholders, 55 stakeholders, participated in what was known as the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. It was a process facilitated by the Center for Climate Strategies. It involved six technical work groups covering every sector of the state's economy. It took hundreds of hours of work and meetings between April of 2007 and January of 2008, and came up with 46 consensus policy recommendations in these six different areas, and I'll get to that in just a moment. The output of the report was could be summarized by this graph, I think. The black line showing if we do nothing, where greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota were expected to go. A projected action, the red line, those things that we already were doing at that time, most notably in the area of renewable energy and energy efficiency, that were already bending the curve on emissions going forward. And then it's hard to tell, but the green line, which is really overlaid by the black line, indicated the green line being, the black line being the targets that were set by the Next Generation Energy Act in 2007, and a combination of measures that were recommended, the 46 measures that were recommended, if they had all been enacted fully at that time, they pretty much, at least with the numbers we were using then, achieved the goal that we were attempting to achieve with the black line. Suffice to say that we've fallen off of that line. We're probably somewhat better than the red line, but certainly not where the green and black lines are. The recommendations that came out indicated a number of areas with high greenhouse gas reduction potential. And just so you understand the key on the bottom here, these represent recommendations in the six different technical working group areas. AFW is agriculture, forestry, and waste. RCI is residential, commercial, industrial, basically the building sector and the manufacturing sector. TLU is transportation and land use. ES, energy supply. And then there's a sixth area known as cross-cutting, those issues that were across all areas. And the way to read this graph is that the options with the highest greenhouse gas reduction potential, at least with the analysis that was done then, are those from left to right. And I think that one of the concerns that we have looking at this today is that a number of the assumptions that were made to generate these numbers, particularly in the agriculture, forestry, and waste area, and to a lesser extent in the transportation and land use area, have been somewhat called into question, and it may in some instances have been overly optimistic in terms of the greenhouse gas reduction potential that they represented. Not that they wouldn't be worth doing, perhaps, but that the story that we might tell about which options were the highest value options might change with a reanalysis. So a number of us have been meeting really for the last 18 months on an interagency basis to consider what our options are to refresh the analysis that was done in 2008 and really decide which of the options that were discussed then and some new ones might be those that are most actionable. So what we want to do is update the start by updating the major economic assumptions, the things that have changed since 2008, things like the price of natural gas, which has changed dramatically in that period of time. The recession happened between then and now. Electricity demand has flattened since then. Vehicle miles traveled has flattened somewhat. And so we need to get those numbers built into the model. We need to add kind of the new things that are going on now, things that are already in the pipeline. David had mentioned the motor vehicle standards is one of those things that has occurred as a regulatory action that has had significant effect on greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector since then. We want to review key assumptions and projections, not only for greenhouse gas reduction potential, but also job creation potential. Which of these things are really the win-win items, both in terms of reducing our greenhouse gas profile and growing the state's economy at the same time? And then we want to assess the potential for new actions, things that really weren't on the radar screen when we did this analysis in 2008, things like the growth of electric vehicles, solar power and the falling costs for solar over that period of time, and the power plant rules that David described just a bit ago. So before you is a memorandum of understanding and a scope of work. We've entered into that agreement. The Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Commerce, and the Center for Climate Strategies as I say, refresh the analysis that was done in 2008 with these new goals in mind. The funding for this project has been obtained by the Center for Climate Strategies from private foundations. So our arrangement with them is not a financial arrangement, merely an agreement to collaborate as they perform this work. The scope of work includes 20 measures from the original MCAG report. Those things probably more toward the left-hand side of that graph that I showed earlier, and up to 16 additional options that weren't considered in 08. So the timeline that we're on for this is to gather initial input starting with this meeting today. There will be an analysis phase conducted by the Center for Climate Strategies, but in very close collaboration with state agencies. We expect that to take about 6 months. So from today, that puts us in the midsummer timeframe, July or so. And that to be followed by a stakeholder review phase, which is still under design. But we really feel it's important to vet the new analysis with some of the same stakeholders and perhaps some new ones this time around to determine which of these are really actionable items, both near-term and longer-term, really to hopefully give us something of a roadmap for how we proceed from here to build on the great work that's going to be described in the report that you've already seen. So that's that's that issue. I have a couple of related things I wanted to talk about, but I can stop and take questions on this now.
Bill, my question is, knowing sort of where the stakeholders were at 2007, 2008, how much time and agreement do you think there is among them on the reanalysis questions that are out there? Some of the debate over assumptions that were made in that first phase report, and how optimistic, I guess, is the question. How optimistic are you that people will agree on revising assumptions?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question. You know, in some sectors, this conversation has been ongoing and very intensive since 2008. I would say the energy supply sector is probably the best example of that. We've had, you know, any number of conversations every legislative session. Mm-hmm. There are bills in this area. We took major steps in the energy supply area last legislative session. So this has been an ongoing discussion, and the stakeholders are all very firmly engaged in it. And while there isn't always complete agreement, there is good understanding of where the pros and cons are, where people are staked out. It's not as clear to me in some of these other sectors where that level of engagement as a climate change topic really hasn't been as persistent or ongoing. Agriculture is probably one of those areas. Transportation is probably one of those areas where we talk about those issues, but we don't talk about them so much as climate change-related issues. And they're pulling the stakeholders back together and really engaging them meaningfully is going to take, I think, more effort, and identifying who really are the people who can speak for those sectors. That was a serious effort, I know, in 2007, 2008. It will be again this time.
Thanks. Other questions? Brian.
Bill, I'm curious on how some of these factors got joined together. For example, the first one, forestry management, I think you clarified that as agriculture, forestry, waste.
Yes.
You can just take that one for example and clarify what that means.
Sure. There was a need, given this, the breadth of greenhouse gas producing activities in the state's economy, to group some of these things together in order that we could meaningfully talk about them. Because and the agriculture and forestry waste is a good example. It was felt that there was enough commonality in terms of the sources of emissions, the types of activities that led to either sequestration of CO2, greenhouse gases, or the production of greenhouse gases. There was enough similarity within that cluster that they could meaningfully meet and discuss those issues. That's not to say that it was at times a bit of a cacophony, because while they certainly had things in common, they also had things that were very different based on that kind of a grouping of sectors. The waste sector of those was really kind of a what's wrong with this picture sort of a thing. I would say agriculture and forestry were more closely connected, similar issues. The waste issues got into recycling and issues that weren't as relevant to the ag and forestry sectors. So I think it was for the purpose of getting this into bite-sized chunks so that we could have a process without having hundreds of people at the table. As it was, you can see we had over 50 people, and that it was cumbersome for that reason.
It simply perked my attention when I see forestry management. I compare the size of the forestry industry in the state of Minnesota to agriculture. It just didn't make sense to me why they were coupled together. It would seem like ag would be a standalone.
And Mr. Chairman, I mean, there would have been a variety of ways
no
to
offense.
Do it. There would have been a variety of ways to do this. This happened to be the structure that the consultant Center for Climate Strategies brought to the table. This is the way they were doing this analysis in other states around the country. We accepted it as the approach that they were
doing. So let me ask a question to follow on that. Will we use the same structure in this report in updating this information?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we will accept that the measures that we're going to be evaluating are specific to agriculture in one case or forestry in another. It only becomes relevant at the point when you're trying to group, in this case it was technical working groups, to work on these issues, that we needed some sort of a way to break it down and combine things a little bit so that it wasn't so cumbersome.
Mm-hmm. Great. Any other questions? Kristen.
I'm wondering, Bill, the 16 new options that weren't considered in 2008, can you just say something very briefly about how those were created and the nature of those?
Certainly, and I would say we're not complete with that part of the process yet. We're still in the business of identifying which new options we want to consider. Some of it was just obvious because they were things that hadn't been considered in 2008 and that we know are of significance, great significance now. The rise of solar energy, for example, was something. Solar at that time was so expensive that it really wasn't part of the conversation. I mean, it was generically in the sense that we were talking about renewable energy, but we were talking almost exclusively about wind energy at that point. It's the same way with electric vehicles. They were, you know, we were starting to see the first vehicles, but they really hadn't gained any market traction yet, and there, no one was sure that they would. And now it's clear that there's a real market for them and a potential for a much larger market. And so it's really those kinds of considerations that go into identifying what things that are different from 2008 that we ought to consider this time.
All right. Thanks, Bill. So, and I know you've got one more topic.
Two more quick topics, okay. But one slide each. Mr. Chair, related efforts that I just wanted to report on. And many of the people in this room are involved in this, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. But Minnesota is one of four states that have been selected to participate in a Clean Energy Policy Academy under the auspices of the Department of Energy, Federal Department of Energy, with leadership from Employment and Economic Development, Commerce, Agriculture, EQB, and others. We have put together a team that is really working on how to better integrate our economic development strategies with our clean energy policies so that we can better achieve Minnesota's clean energy goals and our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And we're really hoping that there are some of the ideas that come out of this process will inform what I just described in the analysis that we're doing here. That work is ongoing now. I am privileged to be one of the co-chairs along with Ellen Anderson and Deputy Commissioner Robin Sternberg at Employment and Economic Development. That work is set to wrap up in September of this year, and it's a very intensive process and one that we're hoping really, among other things, helps to break down some of the silos within state government on how we move forward on economic development in this particular area. And then the second thing I wanted to just mention briefly, last session the legislature directed our department to prepare a scope for an energy futures study. The focus is really on understanding how we can transition our economy to one that doesn't rely on fossil fuels over time. We have worked with the Rocky Mountain Institute to prepare that scoping document, and it's been presented now last month to the Legislative Energy Commission, and they will be the ones to determine whether or not to proceed to the full study, which is probably about an 18-month and $1.5 million study effort if we decide to move forward with it. But it raises many of the same questions around our future energy policy and greenhouse gas reduction strategies that you all are considering as part of this effort. So I wanted to make sure you were aware of that as well. Good.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay.
Just to follow up on that energy future study, you know, it's a good read. I know it's extra reading, but I would encourage everybody to take a look at that on the board and our staff. It was well done. Rocky Mountain Institute did a fabulous job. And to be able to achieve a future of either 100% or whatever less of, without fossil fuels is a future you can try to imagine. But without something like this, I think it's important. I think that they're onto something that we should all of us encourage to be able to do, and it'll help us in the pathway forward.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Kate. You got a question, Bill.
Thanks for the update. I had a question on the National Governors Association. I think the exciting thing about economic development is it's like people in places on the ground. It's less out of in the policy world and sort of really grounds it. And I have been part of a group thinking about energy and resilience at the Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant site. So one of the big, I would say the biggest in terms of size and scope redevelopment opportunity in the state. You look at the Ford plant. You look at what's happening in Minneapolis around the new stadium. Just thinking about and Rochester with the Destination Medical Center, think of these really major economic development things, and this may already be happening, and if it is, great. Just wanted to bring it out that we're thinking about grounding this in economic development and redevelopment spots around the state, and they're pretty, it's clear where that's going to be in the next few years, and so how is this mapping on to that, like in a real geographically focused kind of mm-hmm.
Sure,
way.
And we're in the early stages of the project, and the focus at this point is on the various clean energy sectors where Minnesota has a comparative advantage. We're looking at wind, solar, energy efficiency, biofuels, biochemicals, and then all the other distributed generation technologies. The idea at this point is to really understand the supply chains associated with each of those, where that job creation is taking place now that we're just not kind of keeping track of. And then a related conversation is in the area of financing of projects and getting access to capital for those things that really are great opportunities, but for a variety of reasons just don't get the funding that they need to move from concept phase to completion. I would say at this point that the work is not geographic specific. It's more on a statewide basis, but it certainly could be applied to specific scenarios in instances like those that you describe.
Great. Brian.
I wonder if we could get staff to email a link to that future study that Commissioner Rothman mentioned.
Yep, sure. That's a good idea. We'll make sure we get a copy of that 111D letter that we sent to the EPA as well. So, so this is kind of concludes our listening here as a board member, but I know we've got or as a subcommittee, but I know we got some members of the public who may want to speak on the subject, and we have a little time for anyone who wishes to speak to the subcommittee on these issues.
Hello.
Thanks. Welcome to the board. Please introduce yourself again. I know Commissioner Fredrickson was great at doing that, but please remind us. Thank you.
My name is Natalie Hoidel, and I had a comment on this storytelling proposal document that you all want to put out. There's a lot of focus on making people care about climate change, and I guess I would argue that maybe that shouldn't be the focus, that people really do care. And a good example of that in Minnesota, at least, is with food. People are really excited about urban gardening. There are so many farmers markets in the Twin Cities that people suspect that there are too many, that they're actually driving out competition. And so that just shows that people really do care about the environment we live in, and when we know how to act, we are really outstanding at doing so. And Commissioner Ladmer brought up a really great point about the EQB needs citizens to come and put pressure on you to move forward, and that will allow you to do so. And so one really important thing that could be included in this document is more of public outreach. I think especially among youth, I know a lot of young people that would really love to come and submit a proposal on a direct action that you could do. And so making this document more of a how can we work together? You were talking about housing, and so maybe putting some links on, like a current link to different subsidies that are in place if you want to put solar on your home, and then so you could have sort of, we can move forward with this together. These are ways that the state can support you in doing that on a personal level, but then making it more approachable for citizens to come here and know how to participate in that.
Great. Yeah. That's good feedback. Thank you. Thanks. Anyone else that would like to be heard? We're open for your comments or your input. We will be having additional meetings of the subcommittee as these reports and projects move forward. We'll want to engage in this again. And I'm particularly interested as the initial sort of case is made in our report, that we'll have some public outreach associated with that. Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, McCranche, Carnival Law Firm, Minneapolis, Xavier High School, 1965, New York City, Manhattan Island. About the same vintage as the Chairman Fredrickson, I'm afraid.
Welcome.
As you all know, I represent the National, used to be what was NSWA, National Solid Waste Management Association, has a new name, National Waste and Recycling Association. We were very actively involved in the MCAG process in 2008, and in light of the review of that and refreshing it, we'd sure like to make sure that we stay involved and are continuing to get any information with respect to what is going to be considered and the process so that we can attend and participate in every way possible, since we have a very important stake in this whole process. So I know that'll happen, but I just wanted to get on the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One of the things I know that we're talking about with Will is how we engage in government delivery of information, and certainly those setting up listservs to push information out is always a challenge, but that's, I know, part of the board's mission is to engage the citizens more actively as we work on these projects. So that's very good input and feedback from both of you. Thank you. Anyone else have any comments or advice or thoughts for the board?
I know that Ed mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman, that we would have an opportunity for any comments as it relates to the EQB discussion earlier, and so I would, you know, certainly welcome those comments now if anyone has
comments on any of the board items that we heard earlier. We're still have sufficient number here to take your input. If you want to come forward and be heard, we welcome that.
Okay.
Very good. With that, the business of the subcommittee is completed, and we'll adjourn.